Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I have the pleasure to have two of the authors of Contested Transformations, Race, Gender, and Political Leadership in 21st Century America. The book is published by Cambridge University Press. Today I have two of the authors, Carol Hardy Fonta and Diane Pinterhughes, on the phone. Carol, how are you doing?
Good. Thank you for having us on this podcast. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. And Diane, you're there as well?
I am here.
Okay, good. Carol, maybe I could get you to just very briefly introduce yourself, and then Diane, I'll give you the chance as well. So Carol, maybe you just share briefly who you are.
Okay, I'm senior fellow at the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at the University of Massachusetts Boston. From 2001 to 2012, I was the director of that Center for Women in Politics and Public Policy there. I spent the last 30 years researching and writing on the intersection of race and gender in politics with an early focus on Latina women. I just got back from the march in Washington, which, like most of what we talk about in the book, holds much promise, but is very contested in terms of race and gender, so we'll have to talk about that at some point.
Yeah, I would like that as well. And Diane, just briefly about yourself.
I'm a University of Notre Dame Presidential Faculty Fellow. I'm a faculty member in the Department of Political Science, where I'm a professor, and also in the Department of Africana Studies. I chair the Department of Africana Studies. My research, focused on a single group. I began my work focusing on African Americans, and I've been studying that group and looking at other population groups as well over time.
Wonderful. And Kim, maybe you could just very briefly introduce your two co-authors who aren't joining us today.
Yes, Peter Lien, who
is professor of political science and holds an affiliated professorship with the Departments of Asian American Studies and Feminist Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
Okay. And how about you want to do Christine, too, then?
Is professor emerita of political science at the University of New Mexico. She served as director of the Southwest Hispanic Research Institute at the university from 2011 to 2014. She's done a lot of work on Latino and Latina politics.
Wonderful. And what I think is very obvious from the four co-authors is you've produced a very broad and deep and full book that there's a lot to talk about. And let's start broadly first, Carol.
Okay.
Where do we currently stand at the national level for the representation of people of color and women, let's just say in Congress? I'd like to move sort of more local as we go, but maybe we just sort of start there.
Well, I think we should. The book actually covers the book includes a database that was established in 2006-2007 with a survey on the people of color holding elected office at that point in time. However, we added to that at the national level in Congress through 2014. Since the book was published, so I can talk about what the book says about that as of 2014. Of course, we know since then that things have changed. So I think the things we need to speak of is that the numbers of elected officials of color, especially women of color, has increased. The numbers have increased dramatically over time, but they still are underrepresented. Okay. However, yep. What we should show, what we really want to talk about, I think, today is maybe that since the book even was published, you saw in this most recent election, for example, that any gains by women or people of color have been driven by women of color at the national level. So in the Senate, for example, if Tammy Duckworth hadn't prevailed and Kamala Harris and Cortez Masto, they hadn't won, then women would have actually lost seats. And so it's interesting to think that at the national level, certainly in Congress, women would have lost ground if it hadn't been for women of color gaining seats in this most recent election. And that actually reflects, we're pleased that that happened, because that actually reflects our trends that we saw in the book over time since the 1990s, really.
Yeah, and Diane, you write in the book about your focus on intersectionality,
mm-hmm.
but not in an additive way, gender plus race, but rather gender times race. What is the difference between these two approaches, and what is the argument for the approach that you've taken in the book?
Well, we have begun the we began the book with a focus on intersectionality, and that did evolve some during the time we worked on it. We worked on it over a number of years. Gender plus race gives you, you'd be talking about me as an individual, a black woman, but as a representative in the Congress, you function in the context of interacting with other members of a Congressional Black Caucus, for example, Congressional Women's Caucus, and so you might have some sense of identity, but the gender times race reflects the fact that we see this as a more complicated kind of conception of what the responsibilities of the individual representatives are and the collective representatives are, and that we have to look at these variables in interaction with each other rather than just a kind of additive approach.
And
hopefully that helps.
And I think also intersectionality means something different than just identity politics. It means intersectionality of oppressions, for example. The political context is contested at all times when you try to gain elected seats or if you try to make progress as a group. And so that you have to think of what the structural obstacles are for people besides just their identities as black or Latino women or men.
Now, Carol, the book is based off some pretty amazing original data collection that you have already alluded to.
Uh-huh.
Would you describe these data, not in their granular detail, but sort of how you put this together? And I wonder also if you could describe this great photo on page 7 of the research team in Chicago, which anyone who has the book or has read the book would take note. Maybe you could describe that photo to us and what it says about the team that you put together.
Well, it's actually a very interesting experience because I think why we wrote the book is on page 7, in the sense that when we began this project, like, I don't know, 1995, would you say, Diane? Maybe we first met, I think. Mm-hmm. And so we've been talking about how to study race and gender and political leadership for a long, long time. There were people with us that left and then people came in. So and we met many times over the years. So one time we meet was in Chicago at Diane's gracious hosting, and we were meeting in 2004.
At the University of Chicago at the Center for Race, Culture, and Politics. They hosted us.
Yes, well, okay. And that was at the time when then State Senator Obama was running for the U.S. Senate. So we're in this car driving down the street after we were finishing these meetings. That was your car. Mm-hmm. And we were trying to find one of Obama's U.S. Senate's window signs, like for his election. And all of a sudden, Diane says, there he is. And we leap out of this car. In the middle of the street, we leave the car in the middle of the street with all of our laptops in it, unlocked. We leave that, jump out of the car, and we race after him down the street, thinking we could get a picture with him. So one of our colleagues who's not with us, Martina, left, got a one of those throwaway cameras, which is why this photograph is so blurry, throwaway camera. So we get but he went into a black barbershop on 53rd Street. That was famous I think the New York Times had a picture of it recently or something. So we get out of the car, and then we're waiting there. So this fellow, Eddie, we think his name was Eddie, he comes along and says, oh, I can take you in. So we go in, these five women, two black women, Latina, an Asian, and me, and we go into this barbershop on Saturday evening. And all of a sudden he comes out from the back and says, so he looks at us, and with this very interesting group of women, I think, a multiracial group of women, he says, who are you guys? And so we realize that that's what this book's really about. It's not about who we are as this multiracial group of women, although that was interesting too, but who these people are that we're studying. Who are the elected officials in the United States today? So go ahead.
There's a little bit more. I had the chance to meet the candidate at the University of Illinois. He'd spoken at the law school the previous week. So I'd seen him, and I was introducing him to us. But he, being the gracious person he remains, it's probably his last private time before becoming U.S. Senator, he asked us to go outside. So we were then talking, and then the who are you guys?
But his voice was like, who are you guys? So we realized it's not about us. It's about these people we're studying. So who are the people we studied? We put together a database for the first time of 10,000 more than 10,000 elected officials who are black, Latino, Asian, both genders, all levels of office, from president later to Congress, city councilors, mayors, county commissioners, county supervisors, and school committee members. And so this was sort of the first time that ever been constructed then or since, right?
And state legislators.
And state legislators, of course, yes. And thank you. And then, so we used that to then create an analysis for the first time ever of where do they come from, what kind of districts do they represent, because we added all these contextual data for their jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. And then we also did a survey of them later. At that point, we were starting to, other things had happened since then, we decided to add some new data since then for state legislatures and Congress, because it's easier to collect data on those levels than city council members, mayors, and school committee members, and county officials.
Yeah, I love these stories behind the stories. I'd like to write the book that's just about these backstories, and I think it would be just such an interesting read. Now, Diane, as Carol's sort of just mentioning, much of the focus in our study of politics is on national level politics, mm-hmm. but you make the argument in the book that local politics matters a lot, especially for what you're studying. So why study local officials, and are the opportunities for advances in representation different somehow at the local level than at the national level?
Well, we learned a lot in that process of looking at the elected officials in the database. One thing of which was, of course, that the vast majority of elected officials actually operate at the local level. And I think, you know, we're political scientists, we're supposed to know that, but the fact is we really didn't know that or didn't understand it in quite the way we do now in the past. So I think probably two-thirds, Carol, correct me, of elected officials nationally and in our database are local officials. It's probably a larger proportion.
It's 96% actually total for all people, all elected officials are at the local level. Ours were about 75, 78. You're right, Diane.
Yeah.
But nationally, we don't really think about that. We don't think that so many people serve at the local level. And yet one of the things we make a point in Chapter 2, for example, is that local officials oversee budgets and spend $1 trillion a year. You know, and then they also at the state legislative level, they're the ones that are they're crafting these districts that are creating the districts for who gets elected to Congress by party. So we have to really be thinking about both state legislative levels more and also the local officials because they're very important. We've seen that
local boards of education at the county and the local level. These are the levels at which very much important work is done, and without knowing more details about how those individuals function, you know, we tended to assume that the most important thing was getting these people elected at the state level, maybe to the state legislature, maybe to governors, maybe to the Congress, but knowing the full dimensions of their importance at the local level and the ways in which they influence local politics is also important. Vitally important.
And it's also important because since the election in the 2016 election, all these pundits are all talking about how you have to go local. Because they said that the Democratic Party, for example, is not going to recoup what they need to recoup in order unless they go local.
Now, Carol, in Chapter 3, mm-hmm. you combine a series of factors related to perceptions of political disadvantage.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you seem to find that men of color do not view women of color as facing greater political disadvantages. Did I read that correctly? And if so, how do you interpret that analysis? And if I've read it incorrectly, what is the right interpretation of those data?
Well, this is a very complicated one because it turns out what we were trying to study in Chapter 3 was this idea of double disadvantage. A lot of the literature on women in politics that's mostly focused on white women, say that or on black women, for example, says that they'd be disadvantaged by the intersection of their racial and gender identities, and that we find it's very complicated when you look at what people actually say. So we found, for example, that all groups of women of color are more disadvantaged in terms of their household income, but Black and Latina women were less disadvantaged in education and occupation. Now, at the same time, when you looked at how they saw themselves in terms of their in their campaigns, men of color perceive more disadvantages on the campaign trail than women of color do, which is surprising compared to the literature, but not when you see that other than current income, men of color were more disadvantaged in their own backgrounds than women of color. So it's I think we've made a big contribution to whether what the literature says about this issue of disadvantage is more complicated than just what we thought.
Yeah, and what do you make of that? Is that does that have to do with the conditions that these male candidates face, or does it have to do with their perceptions of what women face, and maybe they misperceive the differences that exist across the genders?
Well,
how do you interpret this?
Well, one thing is you have to realize these are the winners. These are the people who won their elections. Okay, we did not study candidates, and a lot of the studies that talk about disadvantage in campaigns is talking about candidates. So if candidates lost, maybe they see themselves differently than if they'd won. So these women and men won their races. I don't know if you have any other thing to add, Diane, there.
Well, I was looking at that chapter, and I'll just read a little bit that female elected officials of color may gain certain advantages by their educational attainment, but they are disadvantaged by the marriage gap in terms of potential material resources, with the largest being for Black women. Women of each racial group are also disadvantaged in terms of personal financial resources, that is, household income. And Black women stand out with the highest percentage of householders reporting off a household income below $50,000 compared to Latinas, which is 30%, and Asian American women, 14.8%, with men being somewhat more, having somewhat higher levels of income.
I guess the other question is whether as candidates, the women are somewhat, now this is, we don't know this. We have not studied this part because we didn't study candidates. But the question gets raised by other researchers also, whether women of color are more acceptable to the general population or the voters than men of color, who may be seen as more challenging the status quo in some ways. I don't know. You know, that issue of whether, you know, they're more seen as less racialized. It's not clear whether the gender makes them more acceptable in some ways to the voter, the voter not who's white, for example. So they can, maybe they got elected more easily. I don't know. It's hard to know.
Now,
we don't know that.
Now, Diane, I really enjoyed this chapter on the election contests and the paths to elected office.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, what do we get wrong about what it takes to run for office? And what did you discover about these paths to running for and then remaining in an elected position? Is the path to office very, very different at these intersections of politics?
Yes, we found that they were. That women of color are, we would argue, less likely to have a simple path, first of all. That idea of a path to office was one that we spent a lot of time talking about and discussing whether, you know, how does it happen that somebody runs for office? There's a lot of literature and there's a lot of assumptions and some findings in the literature on women, which tends to be on the experiences of white women, European American women, that the parties encourage them to run for office, and or that women have to be asked to run. There's a long discussion of that. We'll get into that on this podcast, but. What we found is that the patterns differ between Black and white women. I think that Black women are more likely to, women of color are more likely to emphasize working with and for their communities. They're less likely to display issues of the assumption of political ambition, that they're doing it in order to enhance their political careers. We discovered, for example, that most elected officials were, once elected, were in the same office that they'd been when they were first elected. And so in many cases, they're where they want to be because they want to influence and serve and protect their communities. So the idea of women as a, you know, engaging in this for purposes of advancing their political careers, not necessarily the case. It may be to help their communities. Now, there are probably some generational differences in which the younger people running for office may well display this career ambition approach. Carol, I'm sure you want to jump in.
Well, I think the big thing was that they run for reasons of issue, passion, mm-hmm. or community. 50% said, when we asked open-end questions of why did you run for office the very first time, you got that, either an issue or a or something about their community. So I think the other point was that I think in that chapter we talk about how the fact that they about 78% are in the same office they were in before, mm-hmm. is it question whether there's a pipeline for women of color or a pipeline for people or one path or is multiple paths or whether there's a hidden hard seal, cement ceiling. I think, Diane, you came up with that, whether there's a cement ceiling for people of color. So they're sort of stuck in these positions. It's really not clear. So that's something for future research. But I do want to just say that on yesterday's story about Cortez Masto, who was the first Latina U.S. senator, she wrote why she ran the first time. She said when she ran for attorney general the first time, it was about the passion, she said. I've always been working on domestic violence prevention. I've always been fighting for people who are either downtrodden or the most vulnerable and juvenile justice issues. Now, with that said, I do come from a family where my father served in local politics, so I grew up around this idea of giving back to your community in public service. That would be a very typical mm-hmm. response from most of the people we interviewed, and especially, I think, the women, who combined those two things of issue passion, of some project they were working on or some cause, and serving their community in public service.
Now, Anna, maybe this I can open up to both of you as we wrap up here. Diana, at the end of the book, you all take stock of what this all means for the state of the democracy. and now you've published the book based on data collected a little while ago. Mm-hmm. Where do you stand now? What's your level of hopefulness about where we are in our democracy, given the patterns that you found, but also some of the, you know, other dimensions of where these issues are? Are you in a hopeful place or not a hopeful place as you finish this book?
I think that understanding the importance of elected officials at the local level, knowing that there are very large numbers of them particularly among Blacks and Latinos, there are not so many Native Americans, but there are numbers of Asian Americans, but they tend to be focused, you know, concentrated geographically in the West more than any place else in Hawaii. I would say that knowing the existence of these, you know, these networks of people who work together in cities and counties and state legislatures, that they work collaboratively where there are multiple groups, and that's not always the case, but that I am hopeful because it's people at that local level that we're going to have to, that are going to be important in figuring out how to manage democratic representation and participation and protection of voting rights and women's gender issues. That's going to have to be done there's got to be representation at the local level. Now, some of these issues don't come up in local level politics, but a lot of them do. So to the extent that I can be optimistic in light of the recent election, I would say that it's the large numbers of, and probably increasing numbers of elected officials of color that we will be looking toward for making political change.
And Ed Carroll, how about yourself? You mentioned at the start, just coming back from the Women's March.
Yes.
Where do you stand in light of that?
Well, it's funny because I go back to the beginning of the book, which in the introduction we talk about how there's been a transformation in the numbers of elected officials, both at all levels, and with women of color driving the change. We say on the best day, the situation for people of color is this situation of two steps forward and one step back, where there's been some change, momentum over time, even though you lose ground. But on the events of the very bad days represent a situation where one step forward is followed by two steps back, suggesting Sisyphean effort with little gain. Lately, it feels like we've had some very bad days for people of color and women, obviously, with Hillary losing in the presidential race. I think that the question of we end the book really with the question of whether there can be coalitions among these groups of people, whether blacks, Latinos, Asians, and American Indians, and white women or women with shared ideologies can form coalitions to make change. And if women and these folks run for office with the shared sense of progress for immigrants, progress on women's rights, progress in terms of criminal justice, in terms of voting rights, if people on those with those interests in mind and shared vision do work together, then there will be change, I think, even after this election.
The book is, again, Contested Transformation, Race, Gender, and Political Leadership in 21st Century America. You've just heard from two of the authors. The publisher is Cambridge University Press. Thank you both for your time today.
Thank you.